sometimes blunted by our institutions, not fostered by them. That is where all these things, you know, come up full circle. Whatever you said, you know, entrepreneurship, innovation, all these kinds of things are actually, they are all, I would say, different sides of the same coin. I don't know how many sides that coin would have, but that's my take on it.
Hello and welcome to a very special podcast series, Unusual Suspects. I'm your host, Gaurav Chaudhary. This is a series about unraveling stories of entrepreneurs, investors, professionals, and academicians and philanthropists who are disruptors, yet not in your face. Disruptions have consistently delivered on the purpose and the mission they've embarked on. Their values are as strong as the mission. While they're ruthless in pursuing their ambition, they don't stray from being leaders who are not just admired for the vision and relentless pursuit, but also for how they're building an ecosystem of believers who consistently push the boundaries. In each episode, I speak to one such leader, talking to her or him or them about the business's lives, inspirations, interests, challenges, pivot moments and turning points, successes, failures, agonies, ecstasies, and of course, the little joys of life and work. It is as much about their personal life stories as about their entrepreneurial, professional, and philanthropic journeys. Unusual Suspects streams on earshot.in, spotify.com, Apple Podcasts, YT Music, moneycontrol.com, and a host of other podcast streaming platforms and directories. For this episode, I'm delighted to have Dr. Shashidhar Nanjundaya, Professor and Dean, School of Media at the Mahindra University. Professor Nanjundaya is a distinguished academic with a PhD in Mass Communication and Media Arts from the Southern Illinois University, Carbondale, USA. Welcome to Unusual Suspects, Professor. Delighted to have you here on this show.
Thank you, Gaurav, for having me. I've watched some of your episodes and I am very impressed by them.
Thank you so much. Dr. Shashi, if we may start off with a very fundamental question that is very current in the current context and is also directly sweeping our lives as we speak, which is of artificial intelligence and related areas like virtual reality and augmented reality. This has particular relevance in the world of education, because they're enhancing our pedagogical abilities. Technology as a pedagogical tool, as an education tool, can be supremely efficient. In your view, and since you are right at the middle of this as a practitioner of imparting education, and you are seeing batches of students that are going through this, how are emerging technologies like AI, VR, and AR shaping the future of education? Is it enhancing student engagement? Is the learning experience getting more personalized? And that is why it is helping them, also the teachers, actually deliver better results. Dr. Shashi?
Gaurav, you are right in suggesting, first of all, that that our education system must take cognizance of and must be conscious of technological changes around. And thereby that whole system needs to be flexible. Let me add the word more, because it needs to be more flexible. With the new technologies of artificial intelligence you can do a whole SWOT analysis of it, can't you? Like, the strengths are certain. I mean, the kinds of things that you mentioned, which is that education becomes personalized. There is an enhanced level of understanding because of that personalization and so forth. Have education systems taken advantage of this? Not entirely. I mean, and this is all over the world. What education is doing is to educate students in AI. At the moment, that seems to be the biggest step that education systems are taking. The pedagogical tools that you mentioned that do take advantage of, I mean, even the immersive technology that you talked about, the AR, VR technologies, are methodologies that several people, I'm not going to say on the fringes, but certainly not in the so-called mainstream higher education, are taking more advantage of. I think the most exhilarating kind of achievement for us as educators, honestly, would be if we could build our academic and pedagogic systems in such a way that they're somehow agnostic of changes. Now, that's not going to happen. In fact, that is one of the pet peeves of many leaders in the practicing industries, that we are not fast enough to fast enough movers in the direction of adopting technology as a pedagogy. And there is a conflict, therefore, between academics and industry. So I call it an irrational chasm, because the challenge lies in application, not just understanding. So in my own area of media and communication, for example, AI and immersive technology hold great potential in the very practice of mediated communication. And nobody would know that better than you in advertising, news, virtual film sets, and so forth. And these are evolving. We actually haven't caught or scratched the surface deeply enough right now. And the industry is still saying, yeah, it's okay, but not good enough. There's a lot of untapped potential in these technologies. Can we do that without doing away some of the human brain work? That's the challenge and the conflict that we have to deal with. The simple answer is to, of course, adopt and adapt to technology as it emerges and just prepare our students accordingly. But I think the real answer really lies in making sure that we prepare our students to be prepared for change. I mean, if that makes any sense, that would be the real transformational change. Like, can we build these technologies as they emerge into the very fabric of the way we educate? So at Mahindra, for example, we take entrepreneurship very seriously. So our students just returned last week, I think, from the India Mobile Congress in Delhi. And they share their work based on technologies, including AI, and they received some very important feedback from experts. Some of this feedback was very encouraging, actually. They said that these projects are worthy of startup investment, etc. So these kinds of things fill the gap between the pedagogy and the practice of technology itself. I know I'm kind of overreaching beyond what you asked me in terms of specific technologies, but I think that I want to remain agnostic of specific technologies and see how we can actually augment education per se by including technology as a methodology and not as individual technologies to be accomplished, because therein lies the kind of stability that we can provide higher education, right? So I think if that makes any sense, Gaurav.
Indeed, absolutely. And, this is something that you touched upon, how we can actually well prepare our students to gain the relevant skills. One question that always comes to mind and people talk about is, it's a central long-run question in India, is about creating jobs for the armies of youth that are joining the queue of hopefuls every year. That is why education becomes the first stepping stone to making yourself eligible for a job. However, the key question that is dominating the discourse now is employability. What strategies, in your view, can educational institutions adopt to strengthen industry alignment, by which I mean that students actually come up trained in the skills that the industry is seeking for to employ them and are really well prepared to become part of a global workforce, Dr. Shashi?
That's the big question, isn't it? And by the way, as much as our government loves the word skills, I think the word that's a much better representation of what you are asking is the word competency or competencies, because, I mean, as we all know, a competency is a methodology. A competency includes skills, of course. Skills always remind me of Charlie Chaplin's character in Modern Times, where he mindlessly applies that one skill that he has wherever he goes, and then sometimes to his great chagrin and often to failure, because the upskilling and downskilling and all that is involved in skills. However, competency, on the other hand, is something that institutions need to build. And when I say competencies, so, for example, at our school, we practice or we build in the practice of three kinds of competencies. One is conceptual, one is practical / professional / technological, and the third one is ethical. And I don't think we can, one can do without the other. And so the The bottom line, when we come to talking about what institutions should be doing to build these competencies, is again to build competencies into the very fabric of, say, our courses. So if each course were to have conceptual grounding followed by the practice of that of those concepts, and those concepts, the practice of those concepts are steeped in ethical practice or ethical practices, I think we would have done a lot more favor than we actually think to the industry, well, to the industrial practice, and certainly to employability. I mean, if you go to the industry, you and I both know that the real question people are asking is, okay, does this graduate have the basics in place? By basics, they don't really mean the skills. They also they basically mean the do they have the understanding of a certain subject or a certain practice? And then on top of that is, oh, okay, they don't have basic skills. But I know for a fact that wherever we go, young graduates are usually industries invest in some form of skilling anyway. So skilling, I think, is less important than the ability to be able to maneuver. To again, if you talk about the entrepreneurship thing that we do, how can a student actually maneuver a task by using those three competencies, by understanding the concept of something that that is to be done, to be a little aware of how to build practice around it and do it in the most ethical way. Of course, I'm enhancing this by saying ethical, because that's something that's really needed in today's world. I mean, nobody is questioning the ethics of technology more than the technocrats themselves, it seems today, right? So that's that. Those are my thoughts in terms of how to build employability, Gaurav.
Absolutely. Another thing that really comes to mind, and which probably India as a policy-making priority should have focused a few decades ago than rather now, is creating an entrepreneurial culture, or fostering more an entrepreneurial culture, because that what it ends up doing is that it also ends up creating a stronger risk cultural risk-taking ability. It also fosters in innovation, and alongside comes in the attendant benefits of capital availability to fund innovation at scale. In this context, how can universities actually foster an entrepreneurial mindset among students? What role do you see of partnerships and collaborations with industry and startups, so far as educational institutions like yours is concerned, to create a very, very strong entrepreneurial ecosystem?
Okay, great question. I wish we had more of questions on partnerships and so forth, and in building institutions. I think institution building and partnerships actually go hand in hand, and I don't think we can do without one or the other. So actually, let me kind of take up from where I left off much earlier, that institutions often undermine practice. And this can be self-destructive to a certain extent, because it is collaborations and mutual respect that can generate the kind of work that fills the gaps between existing knowledge and future applications. And entrepreneurship certainly is one methodology that we know how to do. Otherwise, we really will be left with very little option than to just prepare the student for the existing industry. That is not the, to my mind at least, or in my vision, that should not be the only job of a higher education institute. So classrooms are necessarily rooted to principles and existing knowledge, of course, but how can your student apply those principles? These incubations will be one way. So another way is to involve the industry deeply into our academic practices. This just doesn't mean, like getting the people from the industry to address students once in a while on random topics and so forth. We must invest in partnerships, and in these partnerships, we ground the students in principle, in those principles that that classrooms will talk about, and then expose them to industry experts who then take it forward in terms of this is how you use whatever you learned in the existing practice. That, I think, that combination of current and fresh conceptual understanding of something together with the understanding of what current practices are will lead the student to the future. I mean, so the favorite example I give is, of course, from my domain, which is, again, media and communication. So we probably all know that courses in sports media are mostly unavailable in India. Sports management has taken some space now, but not sports media as much. And yet, you know, the whole nation is sports crazy. The fact that we have not invested heavily in such a specialization, can be a gap between what the industry might. In fact, it might be a kind of a hindrance in the growth of the industry itself. But we know that sports media is a big domain in many universities in the US. In our enrollment, we have several sports persons whose interests can be harnessed in such a way that they can take a course in sports media from a partner institution in the US. And indeed, we are talking to some about that very thing. And that's why it strikes me as such an immediate thing. The fact that institutions must invest in forecasting trends to evaluate current practices, to help societies take progressive and productive steps into the future has to be scaffolded by these kinds of endeavors, like, you know, where we talk about partnerships and so forth. That is the social contract we have with our institutions, the institutional level. So the first level of collaborations can be with this kind of a private or a public industry level institution. Then, of course, you have global reach, which is very much available today. And therefore, you know, the globalization and all the everything that the cat will drag in from there goes with it. So one, not to belabor the point, but a granular detail here is that one caveat we always draw is to predefine what collaboration will bring to the table and not just blindly invest in partnerships, of course. So a last word about the word that you use, which is innovation, right? And I know that innovation is another word that is almost like is one of those SDG goals, right? Like it is an oft-repeated kind of a buzzword. And so much so that innovation has become normalized. This kind of rhetoric, which puts so much pressure on the linguistics of what we do itself, from government, private players, that we are forgetting that a back to basics approach sometimes can exactly be what we need. Some of these can be no-brainers, like emphasis on research, for example. That really is not an innovation at all. Innovation might emerge from research. For example, we have this course called Learning to Learn. Now, that's because I thought it was a no-brainer that we, as our students, must understand how we learn. Not just what we learn, but how we learn. I mean, can I differentiate, like as a student, would I be able to differentiate between, I don't know, propaganda, indoctrination, social peer learning, all that? Do I see the difference? Can I critically think on those? Those kinds of things, you know, which is why when we talk about innovation, it needs to be a product of critical thinking. And that critical thinking is actually sometimes blunted by our institutions, not fostered by them. That is where all these things, you know, come up full circle. Whatever you said, you know, entrepreneurship, innovation, all these kinds of things are actually, they are all, I would say, different sides of the same coin. I don't know how many sides that coin would have, but that's my take on it, Gaurav.
Absolutely. Now, one thing also I wanted to ask you about and talk to you about is the interdisciplinary need for interdisciplinary education, a blended education. And we have to marry several strands to our education process and the learning exercise. Unfortunately, in India, because of legacy issues, we tend to have a very long legacy of rigid structures, which if I am studying mathematics, if I want to study mathematics and with philosophy, I don't think I'll be able to do that in an Indian university, or at least until about, say, 10, 15 years ago. How can blended learning models be effectively integrated, both from an administrative point of view as well as a pedagogical point of view, too, to provide students with a more holistic understanding of complex real-world challenges? Dr. Sashi?
Good question. Your guess is as good as mine as far as the first part is concerned. The second part, which is essentially how do we do it pedagogically, that's simple enough. You know, administratively seems to be a little bit of a problem in terms of how we, as large multidisciplinary universities become interdisciplinary universities like they have in the United States, for example. It is not actually as hard as it would seem to most administrators. And I'm right here in the middle of a university where we are attempting this, but the real solutions will lie in at what level we want this, whether we can do away with pipelines and bring in matrix-like structures completely, and whether teachers are enabled and empowered to see the structure in its entirety when it comes to interdisciplinary education. For example, would a teacher in a certain department be able to see the benefit of philosophy with mathematics? Will a student on their own be able to see the benefit of, well, the same thing, the mathematics and philosophy blend, when it comes to, say, blended learning, which is something that you raised, which is, of course, a particularized kind of an example. However, that's a good example because blended learning actually allows the student to be able to do that. Blended learning can also be broadened in its definition to mean you can blend university learning with, I don't know, a private platform learning from, I mean, you see all these courses that are offered by several very good institutions, such as UpGrad, for example, which actually offer these courses. And can a student do that? Of course they can. And pedagogically, that is also achieved. And right here, our engineering students, all of them, they actually study media. They study how to produce media products right from their first semester. And going on to their sixth semester, several of them then get into electives and so forth. And they go on and produce documentaries, some of them excellent ones. I mean, that actually is a little bit of a problem for the School of Media, right? Because the engineer ends up producing an excellent product. And then, you know, it puts us into a little bit of an insecure position. But just being facetious there, I think that kind of interdisciplinarity is very well acknowledged. Your exact example of why mathematics with philosophy, and I think you use that with great care because mathematics is very philosophical. The abstraction in the mind of somebody who has to practice tools and technology, I think it's the need of not the hour, but yesterday's hour. And we badly need it today in India because I think that level of abstraction that, for example, an engineer needs or somebody who's so steeped in technology that they don't know the broader, the higher uses or the higher perils even, and of course, things like ethics and so forth, is the need for you know, or the grounding of a basis for which interdisciplinarity is needed. Interdisciplinarity is not so much needed in my mind because it's just there and you can learn it, but because there is a philosophical, urgent, and present need for our students to develop. If they have to get to the part where they are creating and not merely practicing, Gaurav.
Indeed, absolutely. And finally, a very broad question to wrap it up. What are the most promising trends in research and innovation within higher education that you are currently spotting and how are institutions gearing up to offer these, Dr. Shashi?
Well, that's again a good and very tough question. What is the promising research around the world? Of course, there is a lot of promising research around the world in various fields. And one must immediately be tempted, therefore, to draw analogies from technology research and so forth. The methodology of doing research itself has become very technology-based, which is very actually, it's a good thing. That's because it makes research that much the easier. The actual domains in which research is being, you know, encouraging research or promising research is being churned out is in humanities and social sciences, according to me. There is a lot that's already been said about engineering and those faculties, so I need not dwell there, and not that I'm the master of that domain either. But in humanities and social sciences, recent research has opened our eyes in a lot of ways to ways and means that we can develop strategies, right? And strategy is one thing that research really is committed to. I mean, just think of journalism, for example. And I'm one of those advocates of journalism studies that say that there's not enough of research going on in journalism studies. And so right now, including me, some of the researchers are trying to borrow from media studies into journalism studies research. In fact, I must be one of the very few people who think that the churn that's underway in journalism right now, which I don't think is a stranger to anybody, everybody knows, everybody's lamenting this impending death of journalism and so forth. I think that churn is actually ultimately a good thing. Basically what's happening is that the people's critical thinking is routinely being kind of undermined by institutions, but as an institution, the media has no legal accountability beyond a point. Unlike the institutions, for example, of the law or the political executive, right? So the users, that is the people who live in modernity, surrender their thinking to these institutions because they trust the institutions. A friend who's an editor once told me a couple of years ago that a story would earlier run like, two suspects are apprehended, in some crime case or something. And today he would find it almost necessary to write, the police say two suspects are apprehended, So that tells a story right there. In that sense, the news media are implicitly acknowledging their obvious limitations, their dependence on official sources, for example, their dependence on human qualitative judgments in setting agendas, in gatekeeping, et cetera. So research today is showing or shining the path in the direction of these kinds of social contracts and how people are developing strategies to maneuver around the side effects of, say, technology, or say just the way that things are happening. The way that journalism itself, to take the same example, has been kind of exposed is not that journalism has gone bad, but that because the lack of transparency in the processes has been laid bare by the social kinds of communication. So we cannot actually lament it. That is what research, that's the kind of research that's emerging, and that's very exciting to me. I can speak to that much. I mean, I can go on and on about other subjects, but we can leave it there, Gaurav.
Yeah, absolutely. No, very well said, Dr. Shashi. It's been an absolute delight to speak to you and learn about a lot of trends and issues and technology, how it is affecting and also enhancing education, pedagogical skills, the employability skills of students, and how it is also enabling better delivery of education. Thank you so much, Dr. Shashi, for taking the time out and dropping by to have this conversation with us.
Thank you so much, Gaurav.